Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, we'll be talking with our favorite Vatican watcher, Joan Lewis, for a wrap-up of the events of the last week. But first, we present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More to the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. Enjoy.
One day, as evening drew on, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us cross over to the farther shore." Leaving the crowd, they took him away in the boat in which he was sitting, while the other boats accompanied him. It happened that a bad squall blew up. The waves were breaking over the boat, and it began to ship water badly. Jesus was in the stern through it all, sound asleep on a cushion. They finally woke him and said to him, "Teacher, doesn't it matter to you that we're going to drown?" He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Quiet, be still." The wind fell off and everything grew calm. Then he said to them, "Why are you so terrified? Why are you lacking in faith?" A great awe overcame them at this. They kept saying to one another, "Who can this be that the wind and the sea obey him?"
Just when he fell asleep, we don't know. But if we're to go by Mark's account, and Mark is ghostwriter for Peter, who was there, we know that Jesus had been teaching all day.
Again he began to teach by the lakeside, but such a huge crowd gathered around him that he got into a boat and sat there. The people were all along the shore at the water's edge. He taught them many things in parables.
Although, as usual, the evangelist doesn't waste time on prosaic details, Mark does suggest that there were times during the day when Jesus and his disciples were left alone. People must have gone home to eat, for they were not in open country, as on the occasion of the feeding of the 5,000. The fishing town of Capernaum was nearby. And during those brief pauses we read, the 12, together with the others who formed his company, asked what the parables meant. And he explained everything to the disciples when they were alone. But the crowds kept coming, and as the day wore on and he began to feel the strain, Jesus must have realized that he would have to go away, because the people obviously were not going to. He'd given them enough food for thought, quite enough for one day. On other occasions, Jesus would probably have gone back to Peter's house, which was in the town. But how could they hope to get through that multitude? You can almost hear the disciples saying it. But Jesus needs no telling, and when he says, "Let us cross over to the other side," no one protests. And as the Jerusalem Bible version puts it, leaving the crowd behind, they took him just as he was in the boat. A delightful escape it might have seemed to the disciples, but it was more a case of out of the frying pan into the fire. The other side of the Sea of Galilee was the southeastern side, and from Capernaum it meant crossing the whole lake diagonally. If we consider that it's 13 miles long and at its widest part 7 miles across, it was not exactly a short trip. Piero Bargellini calls it a little cruise, but suggests that it would have taken them all night. "So they put to sea," writes Luke, "and with a number of other boats, crammed with disciples who didn't want to be left behind, and with sails set and a north wind, the little fleet is on its way. Jesus, who will not be needed for navigation, settles down in the stern and is soon fast asleep. But without warning," writes Luke, "a storm broke over the lake." And this, explains traveller H.V. Morton, is one of the peculiarities of the Lake of Galilee.
Sudden storms swoop swiftly over this low-lying sheet of water, whipping the surface of the lake with fury and covering it with waves that frequently swamp the small rowing boats. The reason is that winds from the west, passing over the highlands, come swirling down through 100 gorges and narrow valleys into the deep pit in which the lake lies. The water is smooth one moment, and the next it's a raging sea in which men battle for life. It was one of these storms that is described so vividly in the Gospels.
Though the boat Jesus and the apostles were in was not a small rowing boat, but a sturdy fishing vessel, the wind, we're told, was gale force. And in no time at all, the waves are breaking over the boat, which begins to ship water. The waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already filling. The waves were breaking into the boat so that it was almost swamped. And thereby hangs a tale. In the National Gallery in London, there's a painting by Turner of 1803, representing Calais Pier. In referring to this painting, an art critic comments,
"The wildly turbulent scene is anything but accidental. At that time, a seascape painter was expected to make his observations directly by or on the water. Turner fashioned the scene presented in Calais Pier from his own experiences while landing in Calais on his first journey to the continent. The relevant scene is to be found in his sketchbook, together with the comment, 'Nearly swamped.'"
The artist may not have been involved in a storm on that occasion, but the ferries of his time had no such things as stabilisers, and to be swamped was probably a fairly common experience. But Turner painted many seascapes, and one recorded a snowstorm at sea when he was on board ship. He wrote himself,
"I did not paint it to be understood, but I wished to show what such a scene was like. I got the sailors to lash me to the mast. To observe it, I was lashed for 4 hours, and I did not expect to escape, but I felt bound to record it, if I did."
Many have been the storms at sea recorded in writing. St. Paul himself was shipwrecked 3 times, the most famous of which was recorded by St. Luke, who was with him. Paul had warned that the voyage would be dangerous, but his words went unheeded, and so,
"It was not long before a hurricane, the northeaster as they call it, burst on them from across the island. The ship was caught and could not be turned head on to the wind, so we had to give way to it and let ourselves be driven. For a number of days both the sun and the stars were invisible, and the storm raged unabated until at last we gave up all hope of surviving."
But survive they did, as we know, though the ship broke up, and they found themselves on the island we know today as Malta. Fishermen and their families have always had a great respect for the sea, and never underestimate its destructive power. When living for a while in the Aran Islands off the west coast of Ireland, the dramatist John Millington Synge was waiting one day to go out in a curragh with the local fishermen. But the weather was uncertain, and he quoted later the words of the father of one of the fishermen, "The old man gave me his view of the use of fear.
'A man who is not afraid of the sea will soon be drowned,' he said, 'for he will be going out on a day he shouldn't. But we do be afraid of the sea, and we do only be drowned now and again.'"
In his drama, Riders to the Sea, Synge drew on his experience of Arran and its fisherfolk. Moria, the heroine, is an old woman now, and is mourning the last of her 6 sons, all lost to the sea. "They're all gone now, and there isn't anything more the sea can do to me. I'll have no call now to be up crying and praying when the wind breaks from the south, and you can hear the surf as in the west, making a great stir with the 2 noises, and they hitting one on the other. I'll have no call now to be going down and getting holy water in the dark nights, and I won't care what way the sea is when the other women will be keening. It isn't that I haven't prayed to the Almighty God. It isn't that I haven't said prayers in the dark night till you wouldn't know what I'd be saying. But it's a great rest I'll have now, and it's time, surely. They're all together this time, and the end is come. No man at all can be living forever, and we must be satisfied." In his book on the Aran Islands, Synge writes of passing a line of stone pillars with crosses above them and inscriptions asking a prayer for the soul of the person they commemorated. "I remember seeing these standing stones when I visited Inishmore, the largest of the Aran Islands, some 90 years after Synge. And in the little cemetery I saw that the sea had taken many of the islanders." As defined in the dictionary under sea, the Sea of Galilee is only a small freshwater lake. But its storms, sometimes called lake quakes, are violent enough to instill fear into the heart of the most experienced sailor, as the gospel shows. One can imagine the frantic activity of the men, trying to keep the boat on its course, bailing out, shouting to each other above the roar of the waters and the howling of the wind. And the master sleeps on through it all. Sailors, of course, don't want landlubbers around when they're battling with a storm. In the opening scene of Shakespeare's The Tempest, there's a lively exchange between the boatswain and the king and his courtiers, who are getting in the way.
"Keep below, you mar our labour. Keep your cabins, you do assist the storm."
"But there is royalty aboard," murmurs Gonzalo, the old counsellor. The sailor is unmoved.
"What care these roarers for the name of king? To cabin, silence, trouble us not. You're a counsellor. If you can command these elements to silence, we will not hand a rope more. Use your authority. If you cannot, give thanks you have lived so long, and make yourselves ready in your cabin for the mischance of the hour, if it do hap."
In our gospel case, of course, the sleeping passenger is not hindering the men trying to keep the boat afloat. But the situation worsens, and they decide to waken Jesus. And somehow we can hear the desperation in their voices. As Sheed puts it,
"The words they used come down to us through the centuries, with all their humanity still warm in them. Don't you care if we all drown?"
No one was prepared for what happened next. The disciples were not expecting a miracle. They wanted Jesus to share in their trouble, and surely to warn him of the danger. After all, they were sinking. They may have held out a slight hope that he could do something, but what? Command the wind and the sea? Dominion over the waters is one of the characteristics of God in the Old Testament, the scholars tell us, and divine intervention in human affairs is often presented in images of a storm. In the book of Job we read, "Then from the heart of the tempest Yahweh gave Job his answers." As for the waters, we're told, they are the symbol of evil, and so
the stilling of the storm by Jesus becomes not only a sign of his lordship over creation, but also over evil. The raging waters of the sea and the storm are the negative symbols which are opposed to being and to life. That is why Jesus rebukes the wind, almost as if it were a person, and therefore Satan.
He then rebukes the disciples for their lack of faith. And remembering the old man of Aaron, we might wonder that Jesus should ask, "Why are you so terrified?" But the fear our old man was advising was a fear born of respect, of knowledge, resulting in prudence, which, after all, is a Christian virtue. The gospel account ends with the great awe which overcomes the disciples, and their amazement that someone who appears to be a man like themselves, as he is, should perform an action only possible to God. There's a celebrated story known to all English schoolchildren of a man named Canute, who, at the beginning of the 11th century, became the first Danish king of all England. The legend runs that Canute placed his chair in the path of the oncoming tide, which, in his arrogance, he thought he could turn back. In reality, we read,
"He had himself seated at the water's edge, not to prove that he could command the waves to roll back, but to demonstrate to flattering courtiers that he could not, that even a king must accept limits to his authority."
Canute knew, as we do, that time and tide wait for no man. I wonder, did he ever read the Gospels? And now let's listen to these lines from the old hymn which sailors regard as especially their own. The second verse refers specifically to our Gospel.
"Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea. O Christ, whose voice the waters heard and hushed their raging at thy word, who walkst on the foaming deep and calm amidst its rage did sleep. O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea."
In the August of 1941, the English Prime Minister Winston Churchill and the American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt were on the deck of a Royal Navy battleship which was rolling in an Atlantic swell off the Newfoundland coast. They had just signed the Atlantic Charter, and immediately the sailors' voices rose in chorus. If sailors have always been superstitious, they have also relied heavily on prayer, especially in moments of danger or when confronted with the unknown. When Magellan's ships stood west into the waters of the Pacific Ocean, writes one, they were making a leap in the dark such as no mariners had ever attempted before in the history of the world. And so we read, crucifixes were raised and the chanting of the Te Deum drowned the cries of the seabirds. Today's sailors are probably somewhat less outwardly religious. But the sea is still a challenging element. It still commands respect. And a sailor of today might murmur in his heart a prayer something like this poem by Hilaire Belloc, In a Boat.
Lady, lady, upon heaven height, above the harsh morning in the mere light, above the spindrift and above the snow, where no seas tumble and no winds blow. The twisting tides and the perilous sands upon all sides are in your holy hands. The wind harries and the cold kills, but I see your chapel over far hills. My body is frozen, my soul is afraid. Stretch out your hands to me, mother and maid. Mother of Christ and mother of me. Save me alive from the howl of the sea. If you will mother me till I grow old, I will hang in your chapel a ship of pure gold.
And now, I sat down for a chat with Joan Lewis for a look at some of the events in the Vatican over the past week. Come and join us in studio. Joan, welcome back. I'd like to begin today's program looking at this weekend, what's happening this weekend. Pope Benedict, this Sunday, visits the tomb of St. Pio in San Giovanni Rotondo, which is not far from the Adriatic coast in Italy's southern Puglia region. This very well-loved saint is known around the world as Padre Pio of Pietralcina.
And that's where he's from.
Exactly. And this program, of course, is being recorded ahead of the Pope's arrival in the town, where he'll be praying at Padre Pio's tomb in the grottos of the shrine and celebrating an outdoor mass before he visits patients at the Home of Relief from Suffering, which is one of the biggest and most respectable hospitals in southern Italy, which Padre Pio was able to build with the help of donations from around the world. So, Joan, Padre Pio was an extraordinary but very humble man, wasn't he?
Well, he was indeed. And, you know, it's funny, he died in 1968. I mean, most people felt he was a saint in his lifetime, and he wasn't beatified till 99, and then he was canonized in 2002 by John Paul II. But interestingly enough, I have not been. I must make this a little pilgrimage of my own to San Giovanni Rotondo. And I had not realized that the names came from a local saint, John Giovanni, that the people admired, and the round church, the Rotondo, the round church that the people built to him. I hadn't known that. But back to Padre Pio, he is known for so many things. He has said to have had supernatural abilities, to have had the bilocation, that is, being in two places at the same time, which many of us, I know, would like to
be able to do that.
Of our lives. Right, exactly. That he could read souls. He had the gift of prophecy and discernment of spirits, lived on very little sleep and so forth. And we do know that he had the stigmata for 50 years, the five wounds of Christ, which caused him no little suffering and even really humiliation and embarrassment. But it is said that because of his huge holiness during life, of course, the devil tried to attack him constantly, and he would all of a sudden appear with, you know, bruises on his face or his arms, which came supposedly from the devil. But he when he became a priest, he went a Capuchin. He went was assigned to several different places, but when he got to San Giovanni Rotondo, he stayed there for the remaining 52 years of his life.
And from that little tiny Italian town, his fame and his renown really went all over the world. In fact, San Giovanni Rotondo every year draws more than 7 million pilgrims.
I read that, and that statistic really surprised me. It said it's second only to Our Lady of Guadalupe. So it kind of makes you go, okay, what do Lourdes and Fatima get, the ones that come to mind?
Sure.
because being in Italy, we're even closer to them. But
I hope you have a chance to go there one day.
Oh, I mean, I will. You know, it's not that easy to get to from Rome. I mean, if one has a private car, it's easier, which I don't have. But if you're going on any other kind of transportation, you really have to plan on spending a night. You don't go down, spend a few hours, and come back. And I do understand there's a very beautiful new church there, which can seat something like 6,500 people inside, and there's a square or something for like 30,000 people outside. So
I'm sure they'll be filled this weekend.
Oh, yes.
Well,
absolutely.
We better also take a look quickly at some of the things that have taken place over this past week. Of course, Pope Benedict was mentioning towards the end of last week his forthcoming encyclical, Veritas in Caritate.
Right. It'll be the first one really social in the sense of dedicated to the economy, to labor, to those themes. The first one since John Paul's Centesimus Annus in 1991. In fact, the Pope's hint at what would be the content of this encyclical. Some say it's expected at the end of June, June 29th. Hopefully not, only because that day he gives the pallium to Menapii. There will be many festivities in Rome. People will be paying more attention to that than they would to an encyclical. But I've heard one or two languages remain to be translated, so it may not be June 29th. Night, as people say. But the Pope told members of the Centesimus Annus Pro Pontifice Foundation that he said the document will highlight what for us as Christians are the objectives that need to be pursued and what values need to be tirelessly promoted and defended in order to create a truly free and united form of human coexistence. And he said, really, it will be dedicated to the extensive issue of economy and labor. He said the financial crisis that has hit the most developed countries and the emerging economies, as well, of course, as the underdeveloped, in fact, even more so, as well as the underdeveloped countries, shows in an evident manner how much it is needed to rethink some of the economic financial paradigms that have been predominant in the last years. So my own personal feeling is that in listening to what Pope Benedict has said or written, and even his predecessor, John Paul, I think we're going to be looking at the suggestion that world economies look for a way. 1991, it was kind of like between communism, which was, you know, then dying, communism and capitalism. Now, if anything, it's a form of socialism and capitalism. And I think that you're going to look at the Holy Father's message of trying to take the best of both systems and create a third one. That's just my guess on that. We'll see in a couple weeks.
Well, he also continued on this theme of the financial crisis, the economic problems, when he was looking ahead to a United Nations conference.
On Sunday, right, at
That's
the Angelus.
Right.
The 24th and 25th of June, the UN is having a conference, and it's on the economic and financial situation, of course, its impact on development around the world. And obviously, those who always suffer from anything, suffer more than anybody, are people, the poor and the underprivileged people in underdeveloped countries. But the Pope was talking about focusing on strategies to reduce world hunger. And he said, my hope is that the participants, of course, will be touched by a spirit of wisdom and human solidarity. And he noted the many, many places in the world, of course, that are touched so radically by hunger. And he said, you know, we just celebrated the Feast of Corpus Christi, the bread of life. And he said, I want to make a special mention of the hundreds of millions of people who suffer hunger. Now, hundreds of millions, you know. This is, said Pope Benedict, absolutely unacceptable situation, which, despite the efforts of recent decades, fails to improve. And, you know, everybody listening to us knows it's not a question of not having enough food or there being too many people. There is enough food for everyone. It's a case of distribution. It's a case of hoarding. It's a case of certain very developed nations, my own country included, the United States, of just consuming far more per capita than per capita needs.
And really what's
sure,
necessary,
sure.
Of course.
Exactly.
Another big thing happening.
Well, another big event this week, yeah, the starting of the year for priests.
Exactly.
Friday, the Feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And the Pope had already announced this earlier, so several months ago, and he said this is the Sacred Heart of Jesus, Friday, but it's also a day of priestly sanctification. And, of course, this year, and the beginning of this year will coincide with the 150th anniversary of the death of the curé d'Ars, Jean-Marie Vianney. And he said, the Pope said, I was very moved by this, given the scandals in a number of countries, and especially we know what's happened in Ireland. The Pope said he hoped the Jubilee will be an appropriate occasion to enhance the value and importance of the priestly mission and to ask the Lord to give his church many holy priests. And I think we should all adopt a priest in our prayers every day.
What a nice idea.
For this entire year. I've been thinking about that in recent days because I'm very moved by this. We work in the Vatican. We have contacts daily with so many priests and bishops and the Roman Curia. I know the seminarians and deacons at the North American College and pray for them every day. And I thought, wouldn't this be a great year for us just to adopt a priest in our prayers? What do they need more than anything else? They need our support. They need a smile. They need our help in church. They need economic help. They need a lot of things. But anybody who underestimates the power of prayer should try it.
That's a very nice idea. So another big thing that happened this week, and it's news for the American church.
And the Dominicans.
A U.S. Dominican theologian was named secretary of the Pontifical
Congregation.
The Congregation for Divine Worship.
Well, that's Father Augustine de Noia, who's been the number three man, the undersecretary at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He's been there since 2002, and he has been obviously very close to the Holy Father in the years that the Holy Father was Ratzinger and at the Congregation. So he will now become the number two man at the Congregation for Worship, and what is wonderful, he will become an archbishop. He replaces Archbishop Ranjith, who is from Sri Lanka, and the Pope named him as the new Archbishop of Colombo, Sri Lanka. But I want to call him Father Gus because when I first met him, that's what he said to call. And I said, "You have such a beautiful name." And he said, "Yeah, but everybody calls me Gus." I said, "All right." And of course, now with Archbishop before that, you find that very difficult to do. Maybe over dinner. Yes, right. Exactly. Maybe over dinner or something. But a very talented man, a very talented theologian. He taught theology for many, many years, but also is considered to be an expert in liturgy. And he's at the Dominican House of Studies, taught there in Washington for many years. And he will be ordained July 11th at the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington by among those, I think the presiding celebrant will be Cardinal Levada, another American who is head, of course, of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So our prayers are with you, dear friend. Congratulations.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Joan. We'll have to end it there. And also congratulations from us, all of us here at Vatican Radio, to the soon-to-be Archbishop.
Yeah.
And so thanks again, Joan, for being with us.
God bless.
Bye-bye. And thanks again there to Joan Lewis. She's the Rome Bureau Chief of EWTN and a longtime friend of ours here at Vatican Radio. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.